This is Nelson Norman, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 24th of September 2013. Nelson Norman, Part 1.
John Nelson Norman.
Yeah.
Born in 16th of May 1932 in Lochfield Crescent, Paisley.
Would you say your father was an educated man?
Yes, yes,
in
he
what
was.
Way?
My father was a customs and excise officer, and he had been in the First World War in the Battle of the Somme with a view to becoming a schoolmaster. He had received his education in Paisley Grammar School, but went to war instead. And when he came back, of course, it was a bit late, and so he sat the civil service exam and entered the customs service.
And did you have a private education or ordinary state school?
It was Paisley Grammar School, which was a private school, really. Yeah.
Were you destined to go into medicine, do you think?
Well, yes, I was destined to go into medicine in that I had a very bad appendicitis when I was 12 years of age, without thinking about the future. And really, I don't know, there was something about the way I was managed by the surgeon of the day that I admired so much. It was a sort of hero worship sort of thing. I thought I'd like to do that sort of business. And also, in these days, a burst appendix was rather a big problem, and two of my classmates had had a burst appendix and had died.
Really?
in the local infirmary, the pre-antibiotic era, you see. And when I got it, they didn't have any beds, and so I was sent to a Glasgow hospital, the Victoria Infirmary, and came under the influence of this man, Robert Mailer. And I survived just. That was what made me want to be a doctor. So that when I was asked, why did you decide to become a doctor, you know, as you do in interviews, I never quite knew what to say because it was a bit embarrassing. And I think a lot of doctors are a bit like that, you know, they have got this idea and they don't quite like to say why. But,
so would you then have, at the age of 12, 13, started to kind of gather the experience you needed to become a doctor? Or
well, I was a bit lackadaisical at school. I mean, I wouldn't have said that I was a high flyer at school until that time. And then I recognised then that it was necessary to have academic qualifications to get into a medical school. Because that time, of course, we were at the end of the war and there were a lot of ex-servicemen getting into universities, and you really needed to have a lot of reasonable academic qualifications to get in. And so I started to work very hard at school and got my grades up. So I was working at it right from that time.
Were your parents pleased at your career choice?
Yes, 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 I think they were. My mother always was fascinated with the concept of medical research. She had suggested this to me before I got appendicitis, and I said, no, it doesn't appeal to me at all. But it did subsequently.
Which university do you go to?
Glasgow.
To study any particular branch of medicine? Or?
Well, it was just straight medicine in these days. And it just everybody around there went to Glasgow University. I never thought of any other university at the time. And since my family wasn't medical and there was no advice given about where I should go or what I should do. And that made me work quite hard there because I think there were quite a few people in my year whose father were doctors and they didn't do all that well. Because I think they thought if the old man can do it, it can't be all that difficult. Whereas I didn't have any medical predecessors, and so I thought it must be quite difficult, and worked a bit harder.
Did you actually work as a doctor, or did you practice before your Antarctic trips?
No. Yes. Well, yes, I qualified and done a year in hospital, as we did in these days. And then I it was national service time, and so I was taken into the RAMC, where didn't really practice medicine there, but I was asked where I would like to go, because this was the end of national service, and they said we can accommodate you. Half of the year was already engaged and about to be married, and so they wanted to have home postings, and I wasn't in any way involved, and so I said, well, I want to travel, I want to go to Far East Germany, any place, as long as I go travel a bit. And so they sent me to Northern Ireland, and I wasn't very pleased. And what actually happened next was that Bill Sloman, who was running the Antarctic Survey at the time, suddenly had to recruit a bunch of people to go to Halley to take it over from the Royal Society. And he came to our recruiting bit and described Bass and so forth. And so I put my hand up and said, I said to somebody, my colleague, well, Falkland Islands dependent. Where's the Falkland Islands again? Is that not off South America? Yes, he said, it's South America. The job just, you get in a boat and you go around bits of South America and look after people. I said, I've always wanted to go to South America. That would be nice. Yes, I said, I'll do it. And then I heard nothing more. And I was then sent to Northern Ireland, where I was put in charge of venereology for the Army, Navy and Air Force, which was a subject I knew absolutely nothing about. And anyway, and then I was in a military hospital there, and the CO was obsessive about snooker and required everyone to play snooker with him. And I told him, well, I can't play. I'd never played snooker. Oh, he insisted it was dead easy. And so I was taken along to the snooker board, where I slipped and got a hole in his bays ring. So I was immediately fired from the hospital and sent to a regiment, the Royal Waiting for the Warwick's, the Royal Warwick's First Battalion, which I rather enjoyed. But one of the problems was that during the induction course into the military, I had had to return to a court in Glasgow about a case that I had to give evidence about somebody that I had treated in the casualty department. So I missed half of the instruction about what you do, and I found it really a bit difficult coping in a regiment which was very military, and when you salute and when you didn't salute, and having sort of passed round the parade ground one morning on the way to the sick bay, and they all started and stamped their feet and saluted, and I didn't quite know how to respond.
So what happened about going to the Antarctic? And did you apply, or were you transferred? Or?
No, what happened was that this regiment was going to Aden. And so they said, well, you have to find out whether you're going to Aden with us. So I went to phone the ADMS of the day and said, am I going to be to Aden with the regiment? No, he said, there's an order come through. You have to report to the Crown agents in London because you're about the British, the Falkland Island Dependency Survey. So I had to pack my bag and get on a boat that night and went to London, where I was put up in the headquarters mess of the RAMC at Millbank. And then I had to report to the Crown agents the next day.
Who was in the building at that time? Raymond Priestley was there?
Yes.
There, I think, wasn't he? What do you make of him?
Well, I mean, I arrived at 9 o'clock, of course, and he didn't come in till 10:30 for a start. And I found he was a very pleasant, venerable old gentleman, whose first question wasn't, why do you want to go to the Antarctic, my boy? Antarctic, I said. It was going to South America. Anyway, I didn't quite say that. I kind of hid the thing and fudged it. And anyway, we talked basically about the Antarctic for a wee while. He did. And I just listened. And And then he got on to the question of his penguins and this project that a consultant that he knew in Charing Cross Hospital now wanted to pick this project up. And there was a huge penguin rookery that had recently been discovered beside Halley Bay, and they wanted this collection of embryos, and would I care to do this? I said, yeah, sure, I'll do that. That sounds quite good fun. Because as a budding surgeon, I thought, well, maybe that meant doing cesarean sections to get to the embryo, not quite realising that there were birds that laid eggs, because I didn't know anything about penguins. However, I agreed to do this, and it was all a very rapid process because we were recruited and we were sailing in about a few weeks' time. And so I had to go and work out a research project, which I did at the MRC in these days.
Did you also meet Ann Todd at...
Yes, I did meet Ann Todd.
Tell me about Ann Todd.
Oh, Ann Todd was a delightful person. I really liked Ann very much. And when I had problems, you know, logistics or anything like that, she was very, very helpful. And, I mean, when I was writing my thesis, I just couldn't find a copy of The Worst Journey in the World, which was important to me at that time. And she immediately produced her copy and a paperback. And anything that I asked Ann Todd about, I got an answer to. And I met her, of course, over the years when she worked with Vivian Fuchs and so forth. And, I really thought she was first class. And I think she really supported both Priestley and Fuchs to her.
Are you suggesting that she was a power behind the throne?
I don't think I knew her as well as that, but I think she probably gave them enormous support. I don't know whether she was able to influence them in that sort of way, because I didn't know her well enough, but she could be.
Mm. Had you sailed before?
No, well, you see, I was brought up during the war, and I had never been further than Edinburgh from Glasgow. And I had never been overseas. And I had sailed down the Clyde once or twice in a steamboat, and that was my experience of sailing. So this was all very new to me.
So this was 1950?
This was 58, 59.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and what was the ship?
The Antarctic ship was the Totten.
Oh, right, so not a British ship.
No, the Totten. Totten from Tromsø. And it had been the one that they had used for the establishment of the base for the advance party. And so they hired the Totten, which really was a pretty basic ship, you know, 640 tons with old U-boat engines, that sort of thing. And we were berthed in 2 5-man cabins in the forecastle, and the food was largely cabbage cooked in caraway seed and vinegar, which I couldn't eat because I didn't realize that I was going to be seasick. Oh. Because, you see, with a name like Nelson, I had always wanted to go to sea. In fact, I had applied for the Navy. But subsequently told that with a name like Nelson, I could thank my lucky stars that I wasn't taken on. Anyway, I first of all felt queasy in Southampton water. And then I was pretty well under the weather all the way down until we hit the ice. So it didn't go away. And any time that it became calm, when I thought maybe I could eat something, I approached the mess, which was in the after end of the ship. As soon as I opened the door, smelled the vinegar and the caraway seed and the fat mutton or whatever it was, that was as far as I could get, so I didn't get much to eat.
So did you not eat for 6 weeks or so?
Oh, no, I must have eaten something, but...
as little as possible.
As little as possible, yeah.
Where does Dr. Otto Edholm come into the storyline? Because I think you were... Mm-hmm.
Well, Otto Edholm took on... was the director of the physiological unit of the MRC, Human Physiology Unit. And he had been taken on by Bath to look after their human research. They were starting a program of human research. Mm. So a chap there called Lewis, Harold Lewis, who had been in the British North Greenland expedition, and he was part of Ed Holmes' unit. And Ed Holmes put him in charge of the Antarctic research. Ed Holmes had written a lot about it was basically brought up in Canada, in northern Canada, and he had written extensively about human responses to cold. And so he was a pretty switched-on scientist, very good, in fact. But we didn't have a lot to do with them, the vast doctors. I mean, it was mainly Lewis that was in charge. But I had this very short period of preparation. And when I got there, Lewis said, right, here's a copy of Dr. Ed Holmes' book. Go and read it and then devise a research project. Well, I mean, I hadn't any research experience at all. I read the book, which didn't actually mean anything to me at that time. Mm-hmm. And kind of worked out some kind of basic project, which they helped me to put together and get me some means of making a few measurements. There was a guy called Heinz Wolff, who was a bioengineer, kind of mad scientist, but a very, very highly intelligent man, and he gave me some of his equipment, which was a knitted vest that you could wear of thermal couples so that you could measure the subclothing temperature. And then he gave me a watch which had a thermometer sticking out, and that was to allow me to determine how much time people spent in temperatures below zero. And certainly it stopped as soon as it went out, but it didn't start when I came back in again. So it wasn't all that great. And then I had an anemometer that, whittling thing that gave me the wind speed and the wet and the dry bulb temperature. These were all the classical things that you did for environmental physiology. Didn't quite know what to do with them, but I had the equipment.
But did you know what you were looking for? Did you have a focus for your...
No, I didn't know what I was looking for. I was measuring activity patterns, and I was measuring the temperature in that people were exposed to 24 hours of the day, sort of thing, in rotation, and writing it all down, both their activity and their their exposure environment, as it were, in terms of temperature and wind speed and so forth, and what they were doing. But I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know why, and I didn't know what I was going to do with it. So at the end of the year, I had this vast amount of paper, and I returned to the MRC with this paper. And the guys were all away doing something fancy in Aden by this time about heat acclimatization. And I was given a desk there, and there was nobody else in the whole department apart from the cleaner. And there was a limited amount I could discuss with the cleaner. They put me up in the headquarters REMC mess at Millbank. The next man up was a full colonel and beyond, and none of them were kind of interested in talking to me either. So I was very lonely for a while everybody was away. And I started going to pubs and trying to meet somebody that I could talk to, and I wasn't very good at that, so I didn't meet anybody and didn't have anybody to talk to. So then I started going to the pictures, and I'd go in the morning and decide where I was going to go that night. And eventually, in the next few years, there was no film I could see because I had seen them all pretty well. So it was a bad time. And then I sat down and I said to myself, well, this is just ridiculous. I have to try and do something with this stuff. So I found there was a library, and as you might imagine, in a place like the Medical Research Council. So I went and found a journal of applied physiology, as it happened, and I kind of paper that I thought was really quite interesting. So I read a few papers, and then I began to see how you could put this data together in some sort of way. So and I could read the literature. So I began to work away at it. And then I began to think, because basically what I was told to do was find out about acclimatization to cold, well-established measures of acclimatization to heat. But nothing seems to happen when you go into a cold, live in a cold climate. Why is that? That was the basis of the project.
See. Was that your idea? Was that Ed Holmes?
No, that was their idea. That was the
so you're doing it on his behalf, effectively.
Yes. Well, he's throwing out an idea. Mm. Why are humans not acclimatized to cold? So I didn't even know what acclimatization was, of course. So I read about that. Then I read what had happened when animals were exposed to the cold, when humans were exposed to the cold. That was one aspect. And then the activity thing, I could work that out a bit better. And I found that there had been quite a bit of writing about activity and calorie expenditure and this sort of thing. There were papers on Sandhurst cadets and training and coal miners and Fife and this sort of thing, Olympic athletes. And so I said, well, okay, if I can work out the Antarctic explorers, then I can have something to compare them with. So I did that bit. And then I had this environmental stuff, and I then read Ed Holmes' book and found that he had some quite interesting things that in these sort of polar regions, when the wind speed got up, the temperature tended to go down and that sort of thing. And so I started with my meteorological stuff, getting the double frequency tables worked out and so forth and so on. And then one day I was travelling the tube from Millbank, whatever the tube station was, to Hampstead, and I was thinking about this, and somehow I could see through a haze what I was trying to do, and I couldn't quite grasp it, but I could see several strands here that were beginning to make sense. And then I found I had missed Hampstead, and so I had to get off and go the other way, and then I arrived back at Charing Cross, and it was 11 o'clock before I got off the thing, but I basically had a thought in my mind, and I rushed up to the place and wrote it down, and I had got this concept then of three temperature grades, you know, temperature of the station, the temperature that the guy was exposed to, and the subclothing temperature. And I worked that out, and annual means and this sort of thing, and came to the conclusion that the reason that there was no real change in response to a cold climate was because the body wasn't actually exposed to a cold climate. And I worked out how long they had spent out of doors, and found that that was related to the climate too. That when it was cold, the guys didn't stay out too long, and that the human was had to be maintained in a very close environmental temperature to survive, and that was the subclothing temperature. And why it was different from animals was that human beings could use their intelligence, their clothing, their heating, and their housing to assist them to maintain the environmental temperature that they needed, which was actually quite a new concept at that time. And I was quite pleased with that, and I wrote that into a thesis.
How was that received?
Well, it was... when I spoke to Harold Lewis about it, he poo-pooed the whole thing. He said, we're not interested in theses here. We're only interested in papers. Go and write a paper. So I wanted an MD thesis, you see. So I went away and mulled over this thing. And I thought, well, I'll go to see Ed Holmes. So I went to see Ed Holmes, who was the Holy of Holies at that time. And... I was rather surprised to be ushered straight in, because he was expecting a high hegian from the Medical Research Council called Nixon, and they had got the names mixed. And he was about to throw me straight out, and I slapped a diagram down, and I slapped another one and down, and he got interested in the thing, and he got quite fascinated in what I was trying to say, which... And I, at the end of the day, he was really quite impressed. And I said, what I really would like to do is to write an MD thesis. And could I have your authority to go to Glasgow and present this to Professor Gary and see what he thought? Of course, he said, you must. And tell him I sent you. So that was it. That was a turning point in my career, really. And I came out of that place with an absolute splitting headache. You know? So, and then, of course, I eventually wrote the thesis and went to Glasgow, and he thought it was good. He was keen on it too, and said, yes, get that in. And then Fuchs by this time was back from the Antarctic, and so I presented it to him. And he thought it was absolute rubbish, because he thought I was taking the piss out of the Antarctic explorer, saying it wasn't really rock.
Oh, they were dematching them, was it?
Yes, it was dematching. And I said, no, they're just using our energies and strength to allow us to function, you know. And that wasn't like, the Cherry Garrard's book with metal fillings contracting and being spat out, sort of thing, because I had rather facetiously and stupidly said that the mouth would be colder eating an ice cream, which it would. So, anyway, he was unimpressed. And anyway, I presented the thing and I left him a copy. But the interesting thing about that was that 10 years later, when Edholm was about to finish up, he had a conference in Cambridge in which Sir Vivian was invited to open. And he was quoting my thesis by the yard by that time. So I ended up all right.
Okay, so you're now on the ship travelling south, not feeling very well, and you're off the bay at Halley.
Mm-hmm.
As somebody who wasn't really intending to go to the Antarctic in the first place, what was it like for you to suddenly arrive at this desolate place?
I mean, when I saw Halley, it was nothing. It was just ice, you know. But I was quite... interested in it, keen to get in, keen to get to grips with the job and with what we were doing. I was quite happy about it by that time. My sister had said to me when I told her I was going to the Antarctic, but you don't even like a draught. However, no, I was very much involved and interested in this job that I had acquired. So my impression was... interested, really.
By this time, the hut to that point belonged to the Royal Society. It was being transferred to Fitz, I think, wasn't it?
That's right.
Was it some sort of ceremony, or was it just a...
No, we were too busy, really, with the unloading and the reloading, and there were two teams. I was with on the ship with the unloading thing, and we hardly met the other bunch, you know. We just sort of ran into them, and they were all so busy with packing up and getting out, and we were trying to get in, so that there was very little intercourse. I suppose we had a party when we arrived on the ship, where everybody got drunk. And then there was a monumental party before they left. And as I said in the thing, we were all quite glad to see them go so that we could get on with the thing and do what we had to do. And of course we had the Norwegian crew too that we had tried to be friends with, but none of us could speak Norwegian. They were part of this carry-on as well.
Were you expecting to be living underground?
No, I didn't really. We weren't told that. So but it wasn't a great shock.
Sorry?
Really. It wasn't really a great shock.
It wasn't?
No, I didn't find it too much of a shock, although I was surprised, I suppose. I mean, by that time we had this great shaft that you had to climb down to the front door. And the back door, as we called it, was through the roof. where there were sort of boxes and you had to keep adding another box and you could get in the back door.
There's a shaft, you mean? Extending the shaft upwards?
Yeah. Expanding the shaft to the front door, but the back door through the roof, you just had to keep adding a sawn box onto it. It didn't get buried quite so rapidly because by that time we had discovered that if you left things sticking up in a blizzard, then it levelled very quickly, and so we didn't leave things sticking up that were avoidable, and it didn't accumulate quite so rapidly. There was a learning process in the whole thing, really.
Was it at all luxurious, this subterranean hut?
Well, it was to a certain extent in that it was warm, and in these days, of course, at home we didn't have central heating. And winters were cold. I mean, we grew up in a house with coal fires, maybe a couple of coal fires and drafts everywhere, and it wasn't very warm. Whereas there, we had a comfortable lounge which had a great big coal fire in it. I mean, a closed coal fire. And the bunk rooms were very warm, and we weren't used to sleeping in a nice warm bedroom. So to that extent, it was luxurious, I suppose. The food was all right. I mean, the army cook was a good cook, but he couldn't really be bothered too much with the cooking. But that didn't matter too much because he could produce magnificent feeds at birthdays and Christmas and so forth. And it became more important during winter, when people didn't have much activity and when their appetites went off and when they got a bit dejected, you know, with boredom and so forth. But, no, it was all right.
What were the medical facilities like?
Well, when I was taken on, I was told, well, they're all very well examined, you know, so you won't have any illness. They're all fit and healthy. And we're giving you the medical equipment of a battle cruiser so that you'll have plenty of stuff to cope with, you see. So, that's fine. The youth of a newly qualified doctor thought you could cope with that. And then, you know, in the way down, I thought, this very healthy crew. When I thought of my own medical examination, which was done by some old colonel or other, which consisted of sort of a pee in a bottle and cough. And then I thought, well, you know, that's not much of a medical examination. And, of course, there were a few people who had problems that I had to cope with. And then this great mass of drugs, and most of which I had never heard of, and a lot of equipment. I mean, years and years, I wondered what horseless wax was used for example. I just only discovered it when I was a consultant surgeon. And
what is it used for?
When you open a skull, the bone bleeds, and this is wax stuff that you put around the cut edge of the bone to stop it bleeding. So I didn't think I was going to be doing any brain surgery.
So what sort of medical work did you find yourself having to do? Don't name names, of course, but examples of the illnesses or conditions you have to deal with.
Well, the first thing I did was I organised a proper sick bay and built myself an operating table in case I had to do something, and was quite delighted that I didn't when it came to the bit, although I rather thought I could cope with it if it happened. And then, there were lots of cut fingers and that sort of stuff. It was basic stuff. But then there was dental problems too, and I found I had to take out a tooth, for example, which I had been taught to do by the army before I left, so that worked out all right. And then somebody jumped in a piece of metal, of with a wood, I mean, with a nail sticking out of it, stuck into his foot. I mean, these were the things. And I think the most difficult one, because I didn't have any really serious illnesses, the most difficult one was with the auroral observer, who spent his time sticking his head out every night, you know, to see the aurora and taking pictures of it and this sort of thing and coming back in again. And I worked with them as a kind of assistant auroral observer. And his nose started to bleed and it gushed with blood. And in retrospect, I think this was this gymnastics of vessels expanding and contracting, you know, every night in intense cold, and then the dryness of the hut because it was very dry. So I did the usual thing. I packed this nose and left it for a few hours and took the pack out, and it started to bleed again. So I did it again, twice, and left it for a day, and then 2 days. And every time I took this pack out, it bled again. And what I really needed was a cautery. I didn't have a cautery. And so I kind of discussed this with the other mate I had, who's the diesel mechanic. We went out, we got the heating plug out of a tractor, for starting it. And he hammered this into a kind of cautery thing. And we rigged it up with a heavy-duty battery. And we stuck this up this guy's nose, which was then pouring with blood, and shouted, "Contact!" Contact it, took it off again, and the smoke came out his nose. The smell of shoeing a horse, you know. And the bleeding stopped. Fortunately, his nose didn't come off. But that worked, and that was about it. There were a few other people who had troubles, but I think probably the most interesting, the most difficult thing to cope with was the depression of winter. And you see, I was this rural observer, Nye Sherritt, went away with the penguins. He came with me to do the project in Emperor Bay, and that was pretty hard going, and we had to really work very hard and work out how to cope with the thing. Eventually it worked, and then we came back to the base, having been away for 6 to 8 weeks, and the place was absolutely silent. There was no sound. It was normally a busy place with people rushing around, and we discovered that they had all retracted into their own little corners, you know, either very often just on their own, you know, under the roof space. They had got a little nest, as it were, and they weren't talking. I mean, normally we had little groups that kind of got on quite well together and met of an evening and this sort of thing. And I talked to the people I was poly with, and I mean, they weren't responding. And so I then found in my new sick bay, and I went in there at night, and there'd be a sort of tap at the door, and somebody would come in, and they were feeling all depressed. And I would chat away to them about this, and eventually they came out of it, and they were reasonably happy and went off. A minute later, the next one came in, and it was one after the other. And then at the end of the evening, I said, "I think I'm depressed too. There's no one to talk to me."
Was there any cure or treatment you could offer?
No, there really wasn't, apart from just chat.
So counselling worked, really?
Counselling.
Did it help?
Yeah, I think it did. Back up? I think it did help. I think it did.
Let's spend a few minutes talking about the penguin embryo saga. Because this was, Asprey, Cherry Garnard and Wilson tried to do this, didn't they, on Scott's expedition. I mean, were you picking up their research?
Well, you see, if you think of the turn of the century, it was all about, what's the guy's name? You know, the not the embryologist, the just a minute, I think. The chap who was involved in evolution. That's what I'm thinking.
Darwin.
Now, that was the phase of Darwin with his evolutionary theories. And all the big scientists of the day were looking at evolution and evidence thereof. And they looked at the emperor penguin, which was it a bird that couldn't fly, Was it a fish that was amphibious? Or was it even a reptile, because they had skin a bit like a reptile? And so they thought, well, is this maybe the kind of fish to land sort of junction? So they thought, this is really quite an interesting thing.
Darwin's missing link.
Yeah, Darwin's missing link. And nobody had ever seen the breeding ground of an emperor penguin, because they come in the dark, you see, and to a bay someplace, and they lay their eggs, and they bring up the chicks, and then they go to sea, and then the sea ice goes out, and all trace is lost. So nobody knew what happened until Wilson discovered in Cape Crozier by accident in the first expedition, an emperor penguin rookery. So he knew where it was. And then he got fascinated with this, and he talked to a chap in the Natural History Museum, Professor, I forget his name, it's in the book, who was equally keen on this thing. And so they thought that we've got to get some emperor penguin embryo so that we can work out whether this is a great missing link or not. And so Wilson persuaded Scott to allow him to have a go at going to this Cape Crozier in winter. And actually Cherry Gard was a very junior zoologist who was part of the team. And Bowers, I think it was the third man in this group. And so they had an attempt to get to this rookery. And then they eventually made it the way it's described in that book, in dreadful conditions. Abseiling down, grabbing five eggs, breaking two on the way back up when a tent had blown away. And all they could do was survive just by the skin of their teeth to get back. And that was what they did with three eggs. And Bowers, of course, and Wilson both died. And then Absolute Cherigar had brought them back and took them to the Natural History Museum to find that the guy had died that was interested in them. And nobody else was interested in the thing. And until Captain Scott's sister, I think, went, and her wife, I don't remember which it was, hammered the table at them, and they took them on. And Cherry Garland went off to war, because we were 1914 by that time. Mm-hmm. And somebody else in Edinburgh had a look at them, and that was as far as it went.
So were you, in fact, picking up that work?
And then Priestley then met this chap in Charing Cross Hospital, an anatomist, and they were discussing it. And the anatomist said, well, I would like to finish that project, but I would need this series of timed embryos to do it, as an embryologist would normally say. And so Priestley said, OK, I'll see what I can do. And he passed it to me. So that was how it came about. And so I said, sure, I'll do it, but without recognising what it entailed.
Well, what were the privations? What were the things you had to overcome to collect those eggs?
Oh, I see. Well, I mean, George Lush was really key to the whole thing, and saying, well, you have to go and live there for a start. And he built the caboose and took it down in the tractor, and he gave us a little generator that gave us the heating, a primer stove to cook with. And then we put stakes, bamboos all the way down and connected them so that we could feel our way in the darkness
back
to the base. And we used telephone wire, because remember, I was the doctor. And there was a case, actually, that I had to go back in the blizzard to see. That was another interesting one, actually. That was the... Remember that hut that we were building there? That was being, well, this guy was moving his hut after a blizzard, and he started coughing blood after that. And so they sent for me, and I went back. And I knew there was nothing I could do, but I had to sort of go. And this is a thing that they get in horses and Alaska, where you get spicules of ice in your lungs. So that was what he had. But anyway, that was justified doing that. So that was us established there. Then we went down to the sea ice and saw the penguins coming back in, and didn't quite know what we were going to do. So I thought, well, maybe we'll have to sort of take a sample. So we built a kind of a creche thing, we didn't quite know how hard sea ice was either, so we got some steaks and some chicken wire, spent a day trying to hammer these things in and make a hell of a din. And when we finished that, we found that the whole rookery had moved. Then we had to go and catch a set of penguins and bung them in, but because we didn't know whether we were getting males and females or what we were getting. And we had a bunch of very bedraggled-looking penguins in there, none of which seemed to be in the slightest interested in laying eggs or reproduction of any type. So it was just one problem after another. And eventually, when the laying season was almost finished, I wandered around this rookery and I saw this bird coming out of the huddle. And I was watching it, and it was kind of almost looked like a female in labour, and there were contractions in its front, and it laid an egg. So another one came out, and it laid an egg too, and then I got the thing. You know, it took about 20 minutes of labour before the egg appeared. So I said, you know, we maybe got time here. And so then we kept going back up to the base, you know, and collecting other things, coal bags, means of capturing. I mean, it went on and on. And so we then got Dexian and we made cages. And I found a penguin in labour, you see, and would signal to this guy, Sherrod, who got a cage and a sledge and gradually came up behind it. And when the egg was laid, slid this cage over, shut the door, timed it, and put a number on it, and I thought, oh, that's great. Now, I haven't got too much time to go before the end of this laying season, but we'll maybe get our eggs now. And so that went on until 3 days, and not having read the literature, knowing anything about penguins, didn't know at that time that at 3 days the female passes the egg to the male, and then the female goes off to sea, and the male incubates the egg. So we were left then with eggs that had been discarded by the females. And so we reckoned that we had to try and get farther as well. And then we observed, it's almost human behaviour, you know. The female would come out and start the laying process. And father very often came too. You could recognise Father Penguin. And he would be marching up and down in a state of agitation, just like a human father. And so we got the female in, but then we had to identify father and chase him and catch him and sling him in the thing as well and wait for 3 days. The
dissection of the egg was done back in the caboose?
Yes.
Not at back at base in the caboose?
No, it had to be done there and then.
Then, for obvious reasons, otherwise they'd go off, I suppose.
It was done, and it had to get it back from the sea ice up to the caboose too and keep it warm. So what I did then was I got a sea boot stocking and I put it down inside my clothing. And when I got the egg, I insinuated it down because it was a good half hour, you know, back up to the caboose. And got back up there, and then at this little table with a bit of plasticine. And what I had to do with a hacksaw, because it's quite a thick shell, you see, get a little flap up. And then I had to go down, the embryo was sitting on top of the yolk, so I had to go down through the white part, dissect this little plaque off the top of the yolk and get it out. If I perforated the yolk, then I couldn't see anything. So it could be a disaster, you see. And that was quite a delicate dissection that had to be done. And then it was taken out and put into Boone's solution. And that fixed it for a start. And then I took it back up to the base subsequently and transferred it into another solution.
So were you able to collect the timed embryos according to the scale that you were asked to do so?
Yeah.
And these eggs all went back to the UK?
Yeah.
On the, I think, Briscoe, was it the John Briscoe?
It was on the John Briscoe. Yeah.
And when he got back to the UK, was there a welcoming party for him?
Well, I thought I would be knighted, and Drake wasn't, you know, when I was thinking of all sorts of things. And I was also in a great state in case the taxi going across London would have crashed and I lost them all. And anyway, I eventually got back and I took them to Charing Cross Hospital, where I met a rather frosty-faced secretary who said that Dr. Glenister was now the professor of anatomy, and he was a very busy man and I couldn't see him. And just leave them there, she said, and I'll pass them on. So I was a bit nonplussed, but I did so, because things were very busy then, you know. I had to get back into society, as it were, and get on and get to the Medical Research Council and go to the army and go and see my parents and Tain and this sort of thing. So I left them. The research box that had all this vast number of papers that I'd collected, it didn't arrive. I was told it had been lost in transit. And so the army sent me off on terminal leave, as thing they called it. I had 6 weeks of leave, so I lived in Tain at that time, now in a way up there. And I was told this didn't need to come back because it was lost. And so I then went to Glasgow to my old hospital and got a job as an SHO in orthopaedic surgery. I mean, I arranged that, and that would start in a month's time. And we're just about to go there when they said that this box had turned up. So I should now, I almost felt like tell them to throw it away, because I didn't know what I was going to do with it anyway. But what had happened was it had gone in to Montevideo, and then it had been transferred to some steamer or other, which had gone to Southampton, and then gone to be broken up. So I said, can I go to Southampton and look at the whole of this boat and see if I can find... Oh, no, it's all a way to be broken up. And after 6 weeks, the box arrived in London, having been to four depots of British Road Transport and taken all that time to get there.
So what was the final conclusion of the embryo work you did then?
I went off to become a surgeon, and my MD and all the rest of it, and it was in a very busy period of life. And eventually, when things began to settle down, I said, well, I wonder what happens to these things. And so I wrote to Bill Sloman, who was still running BAS logistically, and said, what about this? I haven't heard anything, I haven't seen any writings about this. And I said, if they're not prepared to do anything, I'll take them back and I'll get my own embryologist and I'll work them up. And so he made inquiries, and he found that they had been thrown out.
So they met the same fate as Aspley, Jerry Garrard's.
Exactly. It's the same fate as Jerry Garrard's.
Did you have any scary moments in any of your time in the Antarctic?
Well, as I mentioned there, somebody nearly went over the cliff. That was me.
Oh, was it? That was in the film show earlier. Yeah. On a tractor.
You know, going backwards and forwards with the loading and the unloading. And I don't know, there was some... It was just marginal with blizz and vision, and I had gone off the track that we had. And there was some sort of sixth sense made me stop and get off. And I looked, and I was right on the edge of the cliff. So that was a wee bit of a scary moment.
You refer in the book to a kind of guardian angel that might have been...
I think that was a guardian angel that stopped
it. That was it, was it?
And then, of course... I mean, you do daft and slightly careless things. The time when I had to go to see this boy with a coughing up the blood from Emperor Bay, we had run out of bamboos, and there was a bit between the last bamboo and this hut which didn't have a string. And it happened to be a blizzard that night. And I thought, well, let's just see here, I'll just walk up and catch this thing. And after walking quite a distance... recognize that I must have missed it, because there was I didn't come across a bamboo or a bit of string. I walked on a bit further, and then I thought, my God, I mean, there's nothing between me and the South Pole that way, or over the cliffs the other way. So I got a bit of a fright there, and sort of walked up and down, you know, and eventually hit the thing. So that was a bit of a fright, and it was a stupid thing, you know, to do. But you do stupid things at times. But that was about it.
Medical and scientific research has moved on a bit since the days of your penguin egg experiments. How much? I mean, is the core of it still the same, or has it changed completely?
How do you mean?
The principles that you were working to with your penguin eggs, are they still employed today in that kind of medical research, or has it all been turned upside down by progress?
There's an awful lot of change in technology and things that you can do nowadays with the inventions of things like electron microscopes I mean, when I was doing my thesis, you know, working out the statistics with a kind of facet machine, as we call it, you know, winding it backwards and forwards, I mean, that was took ages to do. And nowadays, you just put the machine in at the thing of statistics and press a button. And again, I mean, I got involved with other people's research in the Antarctic, which was one of the advantages of being there, because I'd never heard of geomagnetism or ionospherics and this sort of thing. And being bored in winter time, I used to say to the scientists, well, there's something I could do. And the analysis of the magnetic charts was a thing. You put a thing called a planimeter over it, and you had to sort of work out the kind of average shift of these things.
Yeah.
And that took ages for a complex chart. Nowadays, it would just go into a computer and it would be done. I mean, and then talking to Ray Eddy, who was the deputy director, his big thing was mapping of the Antarctic coastline. And then they produced an airplane and took aerial photographs, and they told me my whole life's work could be done in 2 or 3 days. So I think, I mean, the whole thing has turned in its head now. As far as research goes, it's much more critical and much more rigid. And I mean, I've been in research all of my life, but I mean, it has changed, there's no question of it.